Welcome to the House Resources Committee. I've set my personal best here by being almost an hour late to my own committee hearing. We have before us today, we do not need a quorum, as officially explained, because we do not have legislation before us, but just an overview. So with that, present are Rose, and Representative Seaton, myself, Chair Gatto. Got it. With that, I'm going to ask that we have to, Exxon will be presenting something of magnanimous importance, getting Alaska's gas to market. Craig Hamer is on teleconference. He has some issues that deal with catching airplanes. And Mark Nelson will be here, so if we can begin, I think that would be appropriate for all of us. Thank you very much. I will. And we have people that aren't have bills up in places, and Representative Seaton is leaving us for a little while to get his bill introduced. ConocoPhillips is also present here. Thank you so much for coming. Wendy King, and with that, I guess it's a good time to begin. It's a small committee, and if we have questions, boy, we've got a monopoly. Go ahead.
Okay, my name is Mark Nelson. Craig Hames is going to make the presentation over the phone.
Craig is making the presentation?
Yes, Craig Hames. Craig, can you
Craig, are you can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you very well, thank you, and we're waiting anxiously for you to begin the presentation.
Well, good afternoon, Representative Gatto and Representative Johnson and members of the House Resources Committee. My name is Craig Hames, and I've recently moved to Alaska from ExxonMobil Canada, where I've been involved with Arctic oil and gas developments and operations for the past 4 years. Recently assumed the role of ExxonMobil production manager for Alaska, recently replacing Richard Owen. And although I've only been in Alaska for a short time, I certainly have seen that it has a lot to offer. Also, my family and I are extremely excited to have the opportunity to live and work in Alaska. Mark Nelson joins me today, and Mark has been with our Alaskan team for many years in different capabilities, and during the last 3 to 4 years has been typically working on Alaska gas commercialization. And I'd certainly like to thank you for the opportunity to discuss the important issue of Alaska gas and moving forward its commercialization. As we know, the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project is important not only to Alaska, but also to ExxonMobil and the nation. The project has the potential to generate billions of dollars in revenues for the state of Alaska, the U.S. federal government, and could provide a stable and secure source of clean energy for Alaska and North America for decades to come. And I want to assure you that ExxonMobil is ready to work with Governor Palin and her cabinet and the legislator to move forward on Alaska gas pipeline development. And to demonstrate the significance to ExxonMobil, let me put a few numbers in front of you. The project has the potential to add over 1 billion cubic feet per day of gas sales for ExxonMobil, which is a 10% increase of our current worldwide daily gas production. The project could also add over 1 billion oil equivalent barrels of proved reserves, which would nearly be enough to replace a full year of ExxonMobil's production. Given the significant impact this project would have on our business, we're obviously very interested in progressing it. ExxonMobil has spent more than $180 million studying ways to commercialize Alaska gas. Since the 1970s, we've been evaluating LNG, gas to liquids, and gas pipeline alternatives. And based on our studies, including those with BP and ConocoPhillips, we have it determined that a producer gas pipeline project will result in the best value for the state, the producers, and the nation. Because of the time and resources that ExxonMobil and many others have devoted to progress Alaska gas development, we are disappointed that the recent efforts have not resulted in the way forward. Nevertheless, we did make significant progress last year in the fiscal framework, and we recognise that we must address the issues identified through public comments for the satisfaction of the state and the producers. And we're certainly ready to engage in a process to address these concerns, and we'll do so in a manner that involves the legislator. We understand the governor is currently considering proceeding under an RFP process. We have expressed our thoughts to the governor and are hopeful that a process will lead to a successful result and progress with the development. We believe it is important that the process not foreclose any options, however. Flexibility is important. I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about the magnitude of the project and the associated risks. Because this project appears to be simply a gas treating, gas pipeline project, the tendency can exist for us to underestimate the size, the magnitude, and the risks associated with the project. This Alaska Gas Pipeline project will be a world scale with significant risks, and it will be the largest private investor in North America, significantly larger than the most model worldwide oil and gas mega projects that we see today. It's not really a project that compares. Because of this size, many factors impact commercial viability. First, there is cost. Our previous estimate of $20 billion, 2001 dollars or terms, is now substantially higher. As we know, since 2001, steel prices have doubled. Industry and construction labor costs are experiencing hyperinflation, and there's a worldwide pressure on global markets, contracting services and skilled manpower due to the size of the worldwide mega projects. Next, there is gas price. Despite recent increases, natural gas prices remain highly volatile. The price before 2000 was less than the estimated project toll. Finally, there are many other risks. They include cost overruns, schedule delays, construction conditions, regulatory and state fiscal uncertainties. It's important to note that project investment will occur over many years before gas flows down the pipeline and is sold at the marketplace. Of course, with size comes complexity and an even greater premium on getting the design concept, contracting and marketing plans right, and then executing these plans efficiently and effectively. Most importantly, size also amplifies the consequences of poor execution. And it's important to note that maximizing the value to the state of Alaska and the resource holders means selecting the right design concept for this mega project and then executing to deliver that project at the lowest cost. A limited number of companies have demonstrated capabilities and financial strength to effectively participate in and manage world-scale mega projects. The producers are strongly represented as project developers in mega projects worldwide and have demonstrated their success in meeting mega project objectives. It's also important to recognize that the federal government has helped address risks by enacting the ANGPA of 2004 to provide regulatory certainty, completing FERC open season regulations, and establishing a federal coordinator position, which is held by Drew Pearce. So one of the questions is, why a producer gas pipeline project? What is the best way forward? First of all, we believe a producer gas pipeline project is of value to the state and the producers. The producers and the state have maximum incentive to control costs, low capital and operating costs, which results in a lower toll. Access to premium market price results in higher netback value on gas. And the state, as we know, receives the majority of its revenue from value of gas sales, not from taxes. There is typically no such incentive for a third-party owner who benefits from increased capital costs. On a mega project of this size and magnitude, project and operating experience is a significant consideration. Producers have the necessary project and operating experience in Alaska and worldwide. Specifically, we have experience on numerous projects in the Arctic environment. In addition, it's also important to remember that this is a basin opening project, and any basin opening project requires alignment between the host government and the holders. The producers in the state both want to develop North Slope gas and open the basin to gas exploration. Also, based on the demand for workers that this project will generate, Alaskans are obviously key to successful project execution. Both the state and the producers want Alaskans to benefit from the many job opportunities that will exist. When you add it up, a producer pipeline will provide maximum value to the state of Alaska. I'd like to talk briefly about how gas pipelines are financed and who ultimately bears project risks. Commercially sound oil, gas, and pipeline projects traditionally have been financeable if they have strong sponsors with proven track records and the financial strength to both provide sponsor equity and to backstop key project commitments. These commitments include any required completion support and firm transportation agreements. Whilst the contractual commitments associated with this project will be substantial, the producers possess the necessary financial strength to underpin such commitments. To provide funding to a pipeline project, financial institutions would generally require substantial, firm, long-term ship or pay contracts provided by creditworthy shippers that own and ship the gas. That is, the producers and directly or indirectly the state. These contractual commitments are substantial, in the tens of billions of dollars, and firm transportation commitments are needed for a pipeline investor to show creditors it has the capacity confirmed over a sufficient duration to secure financing. Therefore, pipeline investors rely on the financial strength of shippers to secure project financing. Through project financing, shippers provide the underpinning for the pipeline debt. The development costs and the associated overrun risk are ultimately borne by the shipper via the tariff commitment. Again, we believe that the producers have the financial strength and incentive to backstop such commitments and bear such risk. Therefore, the producers cannot make firm commitments unless they are confident that the gas pipeline project can be built cost-effectively, operated on a long-term basis, a long-term commercially viable basis, and being competitive with other sources of supply. Because of the nature and magnitude of the risks, billions of dollars of financial commitments, unprecedented cost and scope, potential for construction delays, the parties taking the risks need to be able to manage those risks. In closing, I'd like to reiterate that ExxonMobil is committed to moving the gas pipeline forward. Our company possesses the financial strength, project experience to make this project a success, and we're ready to get to work on putting in a framework in place that makes the risks I've mentioned manageable and allows the project to progress. I thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk with you today, and look forward to addressing any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Haynes. Let me begin with one from myself. I was writing some things down, and did you say very early in the presentation, 1 BCF for Exxon?
I said for the production numbers?
Well, I'm assuming you meant shipping amounts of 1 BCF. Now, if you say
1 billion, yeah, that would be our share, 1 billion cubic feet per day.
Okay, and it the pipe, if it's a 52-inch pipe, it's expected to handle with compression up to 6-point-something and without compression 4-point-something. So
right.
What does the 1 BCF represent? Exxon's maximum share of the shipping?
No, it's not meant to represent a maximum. It's more an example of over 1 billion cubic feet our share would represent 10% increase in our worldwide production, just as an example.
Okay. Another comment that was made, and I'm going to ask you to expand on this. Recent efforts have not resulted in a way forward. Did I get that quote correctly?
Sorry, I didn't catch the last bit. Recent efforts have
have not resulted in a way forward. I'm kind of assuming you were talking about the previous administration, and I'm just wanted you to expand on that statement, meaning that we now have a way forward, or we're still at the same stalemate.
No, it's recent efforts is in the context of previous administration and the where we progressed with the Alaska Stranded Gas Act.
Okay, and then lastly, you mentioned that $20 billion is now higher. The $20 billion is 2001 numbers, and that's building it all the way to Chicago. If we were to use that $20 billion, is that correct?
That's right.
And so now that it's in the year 2007, if we were to, maybe you don't know, but if we were to do the exact project we had planned in using 01 numbers, would the $20 billion have expanded to $30 billion, $27 billion, or do you know?
It's an interesting question, and I don't know, but what I do know is that recently in the Houston Chronicle business section, it talked about mega projects cost increasing. Examples was a Shell Suckland project that went from $10 billion to $20 billion. Some of the oil sand projects are facing more than 50% cost increase in the last 3 years. Overall upstream cost index, which is a measure of materials and labor and steel, has gone up 53% in 2006 from 2005. And they're all figures that have basically been in recent newspapers. So I haven't answered your question directly, and I do not know what the current estimate is. I think it's being updated, but I think you could certainly get a flavor for the magnitude of the increase.
And I thank you. No one knows what the current estimate is, but sometimes because it's called an estimate, we have a pretty good guess. My feeling is we have to guess one thing, and that is, let's assume that it's the 52-inch line and it's going to Alberta instead of Chicago, and we'll rely on Alberta to redistribute it. Are we talking, I mean, this number is astounding. If we get up into a $30 billion range, that's real important to be able to store in the memory banks, because we know there is a number when nothing happens.
That's true, and there's no doubt it. The cost will be higher than $20 billion. How much higher is yet to be determined.
Well, I was kind of hopeful that the company might know, at least, and maybe some people in the audience here do know, because it is only an estimate. I'm not even going to write the number down. I'm just curious to know how much money we are now talking to do what we would like to do.
I've seen other numbers around that certainly in the 30s, but they're not ExxonMobil estimates. They've been numbers I've seen in various press articles. So it's probably in that ballpark, but it's I think it's still to be determined. One thing's for sure, we do know there's been significant cost escalation over the last few years. The bucket is super inflated or heated, and there's been a lot of cost of projects that we've seen that have gone up from 50 to 100%.
And the reason I ask is because whenever we get an estimate, there's always a cost overrun, and I'm just trying to add one and one and see what we're going to wind up with. For the record, we've been joined by Representatives Guttenberg, Coring, Edgman, Kawasaki, and Johnson. And, of course, we had Representative Roses and Seaton here and myself. We're still here. Representative Seaton's gone. Is there another question from the committee? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, I came in late. What is the gentleman's name?
My name's Mark Nelson.
I mean, who's online?
Haynes.
Oh. Craig Haynes.
Okay, thank you. With a question, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
We went through this amazing exercise last year, when we we understand that there certainly be a lot of delays, certainly a lot of delays, if nothing else, on the Canadian side. So what I'm asking Exxon is, are you prepared or are you ready to give Alaska access to its own natural gas, royalty gas on the North Slope, so we can connect ourselves up to gas lines?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, if I understand your question correctly, it's are we prepared to allow the state's royalty in kind gas to be transported?
Yes.
Or through a pipeline?
Yes. Even if it isn't your own.
If it's not our own, as in our own pipeline or own
Yeah, gas? Producer pipeline, even if it isn't a producer pipeline. I mean, right now, I think you're in litigation with the state over Point Thompson. If you were to come to an agreement to let that some of that available out for availability for the state for an alternative line for a smaller capacity, or would you be willing
to? I don't know the answer to that. We can certainly get back to you. I've only been in my role for the last 3.5 weeks, so I do apologize.
Thank you.
I don't see any hands up here for any more questions. Did you want to kind of make a wrap-up for us? And
Make
some great prediction of what your position you'll be involved in after these 3 weeks are over, maybe looking forward to not the next 3 weeks, but the next 3 years.
Yes. And I'd like to say thank you for the opportunity to allow me to speak today. And I know I've met some of you already in the 3 weeks. I look forward to meeting all of you in the ensuing future and working with you. ExxonMobil has been in Alaska for over 50 years, and we've invested over $11 billion in the state. And we'll be here for another 50 to 100 years and look forward to working with you to move forward our gas development.
And I thank you for that. I was just thinking, Representative Guttenberg's question about shipping gas, I think it's on so many people's minds that it's worth talking about at least briefly, that we're in litigation with you. It's us versus you on Point Thompson leases. And, you know, there's no sense trying to make that into anything different than that. We would want to be able to at least have an opportunity to move gas within Alaska and used in Alaska at the least, and at the most, certainly take on the bigger project. I'm just curious, since you represent the company, what ExxonMobil's thoughts are on if indeed we get huge numbers for transporting gas. And besides that, Canada, I always worry a little bit about Canada and the National Energy Board and First Nations. I'm not sure we have the right or the privilege yet of crossing First Nations property with their approval. And I know the way Canadians often think, that at least they've said to me, you don't get their approval, you don't cross their land. Pure and simple. Do we have First Nations approval on a planned route?
I don't know the answer to that, Representative Gatto. I'm not sure if we do or we don't. I know there's been dialogue with the Canadian and provincial governments, but I don't know.
Well, okay. And then I guess the earlier part of the question had more to do with potentially having an in-state only gas pipeline. Would Exxon even express an interest in that, or are they, does Exxon really feel like anything short of moving Point Thompson gas to a great big pipe all the way to Alberta is the only thing that really is worth the major effort that it'll take?
I think it's very clear that we would like to work together with the state to progress Point Thompson and a gas pipeline for the reasons I outlined in my testimony. And we'll certainly work with the state to progress the best option for everybody.
Well, I personally will say I'm looking forward to having some conversation with you, and very strongly looking forward to it. And with that, I appreciate the time you've taken to help us with your, or to have your presentation with us. And we do have some very nice handout here from British Petroleum, which I guess is
before ExxonMobil goes up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Before we terminate the ExxonMobil portion, Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given the importance that everyone seems to be tying ownership with your ship and pay commitments, is there any reason that you would exclude a company from ownership of the pipe that's willing to make a FT commitment?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. Unfortunately, I've only been in my position for the last 3.5 weeks. But what I can say is that we're willing to work with the state to come up with a solution for commercializing the gas, and looking forward to working with you to progress that forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, that's not a hand up, is it? Okay. All right. Well, then I'd like to move on to BP. David Van Tool, and you're going to help me pronounce your name better, I bet.
Oops. Yes. Thank you, Chairman Gatto. The last name is, for the record, I'm Dave Van Tiel, the gas commercialization manager for BP here in Alaska.
We have this very nice handout from you. I appreciate that. And go ahead.
Let me just put it up on the screen as well, if I may. I apologize if that is squarely behind you. It will come into play on one slide that we have animated that might be useful to see as we peel it back. But I'll let you know when we get there. Thank you, Chairman Gatto, Chairman Johnson, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you this afternoon. Really wanted to start by emphasizing a few key points about the way BP sees this gas pipeline project. First is that BP remains keenly interested in getting Alaska's gas to market. It's a hugely important project to BP. Obviously, it's important to the state of Alaska. It's even important to the nation. For BP, it represents the largest known but undeveloped resource in our portfolio. And frankly, that's a distinction that we would like to remove from Alaska Gas. The project itself is important in its own right just because of its scale, but it also plays a very key role in extending the economic life of oil production on the North Slope. Second point I'd like to emphasize is that BP stands ready to work with the new state administration and the legislature to reach a balanced fiscal framework that works for all parties. I think that's the key to success in getting the project to move ahead. And finally, we think that that successful framework is going to set the foundation for a stable, healthy, viable oil and gas business in Alaska for decades to come. I'd like to spend just a moment with how we see the potential for the future in Alaska. First of all, BP has a long history in Alaska. We've been producing Alaska's North Slope energy for decades. That's a great history, but we also see the opportunity for a bright future ahead. In fact, we like to talk about our 50-year future in Alaska. And I want to assure you that it's not just a slogan. What does that vision look like to our company? Well, if you look at the graph shown on this slide here, which I imagine you may have seen in these little postcards that we have around and whatnot, it shows the possibility for the future that BP sees in Alaska, and it just shows BP's share of production through time. couple key points that we can draw from looking at this slide. And one is that the days of high plateau production are behind us. But the good news is we still have a significant level of production today. But that production is going to continue to decline with time. And that's what that red dotted line on the slide indicates. It's important to recognize, too, behind that red dotted line assumes that we maintain a significant level of investment, which we've had historically, upwards of $1 billion per annum, just to get the red dotted line that's declining with time. But there are some ways to make up that decline in production with new investment as we tap heavy oil resources and ultimately from gas. But it's not a given. This is a vision of what we see as possible. And that future is only possible if we have an Alaska gas pipeline. And that's a pretty big statement. So what does that mean? Why are we so focused on this Alaska gas pipeline? Well, the pipeline gives us the opportunity to extend the economic oil production from the North Slope. Gives us the opportunity to unlock that heavy oil resource that you see on the slide. It creates a whole new gas industry in Alaska for gas exploration and development. And of course, it generates a new source of revenue for resource owners, which includes not only BP as a leaseholder, but of course it includes the state as well. So BP's future in Alaska is directly linked to the success of this project, this gas pipeline project that we're talking about here today. It's a vision that's shared up and down our organization in Alaska, but it's also shared all the way to the top of the house. It's an important project to BP. It's a vision that we see full of exciting opportunity, but it also contains some world-scale challenges.
Before you move on, Mr. Chair, can I ask a question,
sure,
or do you want to wait to the end?
You mind if he... Representative Guttenberg, go ahead.
Thank you. On the slide we just looked at where you're showing us your net production, is that building any assumptions on finding new oil, or is it just on what you have now, what fields in production now?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, that does include some additional exploration volumes. It also, of course, includes access to this heavy oil resource, which currently is not in production. So it does include new resources being brought online.
Other than the green. I mean, I'm just talking
yes.
about
the green. Okay. Green on this graph, Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, is light oil, whether currently known or newly discovered.
Okay. And it's a good time for me to ask a question, too. Does the production of viscous or heavy oil depend on the existence of a natural gas pipeline?
Chairman Gatto, we see the gas pipeline project as an enabler for two reasons. One is it extends the base life of the facilities so that we have the time to develop the technology and whatnot required to access heavy oil. And also it's possible that CO2, which is a byproduct from the gas pipeline project, might be used. It's certainly used in the lower 48 in viscous floods and whatnot. That's a possibility.
And can you tell me the difference between viscous oil and heavy oil?
They
have different colors.
Chairman Gatto, there, I assure you they're both black. The difference is just in the degree of viscosity, and I'm not exactly sure what the breakover point is.
And which one is thicker?
Heavy is thicker than viscous.
Yes, and that's the bulk of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead. Proceed.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson, question?
While we're on production, thank you, Mr. Chairman. While we're on production, can you tell me what the flow through the pipeline was in, say, 2003?
Chairman Johnson, sorry to say, I don't know off the top of my head what the flow through the pipeline in 2003 was. It was in the range of 1 million barrels or slightly above, I believe. Maybe someone else here in this room knows better than I.
Okay. Can you tell me what it is today?
Today it's under 1 million. It's like 800,000 barrels a day, gross.
Can you project where it's going to be in 2017, 2012?
Right. Chairman Johnson, right now, the trajectory that we're on, if we include the investment that we're, the rate of investment that we have at $1 billion-ish a year, we're able to maintain about a 6% per year decline. If we invest more, it's possible that that rate of decline could be less. If we don't invest that much, the rate of decline will increase.
One more follow-up. At what point does the TAPS become uneconomical in terms of volume? Do you have that number?
I don't know the answer to that question, Chairman Johnson.
And there to get the stuff.
Okay.
And then they'll zoom them over here.
I beg your pardon. Knows
Someone online that wants to comment on that question?
Okay.
You can walk over there and get them.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead and identify yourself and then make sure you know what the question is. We're looking at the flow rates before we are looking into the future flow rates.
Maybe not.
I'm not sure who that is.
Mr. Chairman, I would be very interested in knowing at what point, at what volume of oil going down the pipeline, and I'd like to know where the time, projected time, crosses with that, that the pipeline under today's projections becomes uneconomical or unfeasible or just doesn't simply work.
I don't know that answer for you today, Chairman Johnson, but I will get it for you and provide you with that answer.
Okay. I had a conversation just this morning that addressed that question in part, and that is that with the new equipment at the pump stations, it's possible to pump a lower flow than would have been possible with the old equipment, which means the life of the line can be brought down to maybe pumping 200,000 barrels a day before you give up, and the old one might have been 300,000 barrels a day before you gave up. So there's investment not just in holes in the ground, but in also pumping ability. And
that's correct, Chairman Gatto, and there's also investment in renewal of the facilities that are existing up on the slope as well that's required to maintain the economic life of the field.
One more and I'll be
last
quiet.
Question.
No, I didn't say last. I said one more.
I'll be quiet.
From the time of we come to some kind of agreement with some individual about some type of pipeline, what can we expect to start having some income to the state? What's the time period? I've heard these answers many times, and I just want to go on record. And I'll tell you where I want to go. The difference in when the pipeline becomes not feasible and we have gas, what kind of time frame are we looking at that, truthfully, the state's going to be in a bind?
Chairman Johnson, if we were able to, let's say the three producers here, reach agreement with the state to advance the pipeline project, it would take from the moment the ink's dry on the piece of paper on a success-based schedule, that kind of everything works right, we're talking about 10 years before we get first gas from the slope. You had said if the state reaches agreement with somebody on some pipeline, that might be a very different answer. And we'll talk about why in the remainder of the testimony.
Not close. The gap between the pipeline losing production capabilities of whatever that 200 or 300 barrel is and the time that best case scenario we could have a pipeline generating revenue, that's really the crux of my question. Mm-hmm. What are we looking at as a state in terms of our responsibility to our citizens?
Understand.
That we're going to have a gap that we're going to have to make up in some form or fashion. That's what all those questions were basically getting to, and that's something that I've not had anyone be able to come and say 5 years, 7 years, 2 years, 18 months, and I'd like some concentration on that if you could. And I know it's a little bit of Ouija board stuff, but I would like some testimony to that effect. And now I think that's probably going to go to everyone who's going to come up here and testify as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I was looking on your chart, and it looks like a 2018 gas flows. And so that means with the 10 years that you mentioned, we would hope that either this year or next year, we would ink. Is that inking day?
That's the inking. I think it's something like year-end 2017, but it's hard to tell in PowerPoint. But
it's hard to tell.
It's about 10 years.
Yeah. And so that's 11 years from now to get to then. So maybe it'll be faster, maybe slower. But I think in response partially to what Representative Johnson was talking about is when do we close the shop down? When does gas come online? And I still have that question is, if gas doesn't come online, does the shop close earlier? If it does come online, does that enable us to make new discoveries? And I admit, as much as anyone admits, we don't know. Yeah. We don't. But we're going to make guesses.
Chairman Gatto, I know that the State Department of Revenue had forecasted the end of economic oil field life at 2030, I believe, is what the forecast said. That's the state's forecast, and I'm not sure how ours might comport with that. But I'll try to get you a better answer.
Okay. Good number.
Okay. Where we left off, I had just mentioned that the project does represent huge opportunity, but it also has some significant risks. And this next slide just summarizes what we call some cornerstone concepts about the project. And the first one is about risk. And any project, really, you can distill risk down into sort of three essential buckets. One is about price risk, another about costs, and another about fiscal and regulatory risks. First, about price. Price risk is something that resource owners like BP, like the state, are in the business of taking kind of every day. We are price takers. We are not price makers. And as we all know, the energy market remains volatile. So that's a risk that we have as resource owners. Then there's this whole issue of project costs. And we heard from the ExxonMobil testimony the recent trends of project costs. As energy prices have generally risen over the last couple of years, the cost to bring that energy to market has also risen, and as we heard, quite dramatically. Steel prices have more than doubled since we did our bottoms-up estimate back in 2001. Other costs for labor, fabrication, engineering, permitting, equipment, everything has also increased significantly, which presents a big challenge to any mega project. And a mega project, by the way, is industry jargon for anything costing $1 billion or more. The Alaska Gas Pipeline project isn't any mega project. Because of its sheer size, it's really in a class of its own. It's probably the largest privately funded infrastructure project ever. We also need to face a sobering fact, and I think, Chairman Gatto, you mentioned it in your comments earlier, that most mega projects exceed sanctioned cost estimates. So while gas prices have generally increased, so have project costs. The net result is that the project remains challenged. Then there's fiscal risks that are associated with any project. Well, who bears these risks, and how are the risks best managed? Well, price risk, as we said, that's inherent to any commodity like energy. It's borne by the resource owner. It's what we're in the business of taking. Fiscal risk is mitigated simply by an investor knowing the rules. Knowing the rules reduces investment risk, and the state, in this case, can work with investors to help minimize that risk. Now, cost on mega projects is something that companies like BP, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips are well acquainted with managing through these rigorous project management processes. As fellow resource owners with the state, we feel that careful management of those costs is absolutely critical to maximizing the value of the resource. Those holding that risk, cost risk, need to be able to minimize, to manage that risk. This next slide, and this is one that I don't know how comfortable it might be, but you might want to look up at the diagram. It's pretty busy as one slide. It attempts to show how risk is ultimately allocated in a major resource development project like the Alaska Gas Pipeline project. And it's what I call a deep breath slide. You kind of have to take a deep breath, walk through it sort of one step at a time and to absorb the whole message that I'm trying to get across here. So if you bear with me, I'll kind of walk through it one step at a time. And first on the slide, we start with the resource owners. And that's, of course, the state of Alaska and the leaseholders like BP, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil. Of course, the premise of the slide that we'll see is that ultimately project risk resides with those resource owners, the state and the leaseholders. Now, there's certain of these risks that are inherent with the resource itself. There's a couple of them here shown in green. There are price risk that's associated with the natural gas markets that we just talked about. That's inherent as a resource owner. There's also production risk, knowing that you're going to have enough volume to keep the pipeline full through time, and even on a day-to-day basis, what your daily deliverability might be. Those are resource risks that are borne by the resource owner. There's also important risks to bear in mind when those resource owners are going to be making those firm transportation commitments that were mentioned earlier. Those underpin the project. Now, there's another risk that we show here in blue. It's a risk for the lessee that we've called fiscal risk, that there's a possibility on the upstream resource that there could be a change in fiscal terms. Of course, we're all familiar with the PPT, that was a change in the upstream fiscal terms. Those, as a government, those things can change from time to time. That's what we mean by fiscal risk, and that's a risk that the resource owner bears. Now, there's a whole host of risks that we often talk about on this project that are associated with the physical kit itself. There's the regulatory process associated with the project might change. That could result in a schedule risk. All these costs that we've talked about, whether it's steel or other materials and labor, could result in cost increases to the project. There's a cost risk. The project itself needs to be financed. We need to get the capital markets to provide money to underpin the project. So there's a risk of repayment. There's a finance risk. Where do those risks go? Well, those are borne by the pipeline company, but the pipeline company is a regulated entity, federally regulated entity. They earn a regulated rate of return on their equity. They're limited in what risk they can take. So that risk is actually passed on through via the toll to the resource owner who obtains capacity on the pipe. That's what the firm transportation commitments do. The resource owner bears those risks, not the pipeline company. So ultimately, all these risks are borne either directly or indirectly through the toll by the resource owner. And by the way, another thing, you'll see at the end of the pack, I have a glossary of terms or some jargon that we fall into using. Toll versus tariff is one that's commonly transposed. And when I say toll, what I'm referring to is the unit rate for cost of service on the pipeline. The tariff includes that, but it's the ream of paper associated with all the terms and conditions for service on a pipeline. To get a low-cost project, again, we think it's important that those that bear this risk are able to manage this risk, because those folks are commercially motivated to ensure that that risk is managed downwards. That's what that last bit on the slide says. Well, we think, BP thinks, the producers are best positioned to manage those key project risks by having our affiliates own the pipeline and therefore deliver a successful project. Now, there's two broad questions that one might ask when you're trying to determine who would be the most effective owner of a gas pipeline. The first one is about qualification. Who would be best qualified to successfully deliver this project? Second question might go to motivation. Who is most motivated to deliver a successful project? I guess, of course, that begs another question: what constitutes a successful project? And for these purposes, I'm going to assume that success means a low cost, timely project that maximizes the value of Alaska's gas resource, because that's what BP is striving for. We think that's what the state would want as well. Again, I believe the producers are the best choice in response to each of those questions. In fact, the producers are better situated than any other candidate under both qualification and motivation and I'm going to explain why I believe that. On qualification, selecting a business partner, especially for some endeavor as massive as this, you'd probably want to have someone that's done it before, been there and done that. The three producing companies have demonstrated success in delivering mega projects around the world. Just last year, BP as operator successfully delivered what up until the Alaska Gas Pipeline project is probably the largest and most complex midstream project in the world, known as the BTC project. BTC stands for Baku, Tbilisi, Shahan. There are three cities in the Caspian region. And BTC is an integrated basin opening project of a total cost of about $25 billion. That includes the oil and gas pipelines and the upstream development as well. Now, that project was completed last year, the oil portion, with the first shipment of oil in June. It's this kind of international experience that all three of these companies have that will help, we'll be able to bring to this Alaska Gas Pipeline project, helping to ensure its success. So one is demonstrated success in delivering mega projects. Another is technology development. BP is continuing to spend millions of dollars to improve our ability to deliver a low-cost project. Some things that activities that we've recently conducted include trenching trials on kind of high technology, higher speed trenchers, and we've done tests on the North Slope and in the Fairbanks area. We've done high strength steel testing. We're developing advanced welding techniques and other techniques. The three companies here also have Arctic experience. In fact, we pioneered development in the Arctic, and now we have over three decades of Arctic development and operations experience. And also, the financial capability is important. For the project to be successful, somebody has to make the firm transportation commitments required to support the project. As was mentioned by ExxonMobil, these are multi-billion dollar commitments. Companies like BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil are able to underwrite the project risks through those FT commitments. Few, if any, other companies can. Now, based on those facts, I think the producers are best qualified to undertake this massive endeavor. So that's qualification. The producers are also commercially motivated to maximize the value of our gas, the state's gas, by delivering a low capital cost project and a low operating cost project. A low cost project results in a low toll, maximizes the gas netback, maximizes the value of the gas for the state and the producers. The state has the same motivation. As I mentioned at the beginning, the successful gas pipeline project's the key to BP's vision of a 50-year future that extends the life of oil production on the North Slope as well. That's a strong motivation for us to deliver a successful gas pipeline project. Now, that commercial motivation is fundamentally different from the commercial motivation of a company that isn't a resource owner. The only source of income for a third-party operator is the pipeline tariff itself, the toll. Now, that income increases as the cost to build and operate the pipeline increases. That would result in a reduced netback and reduced value of the resource. Therefore, a third-party pipeline operator is not commercially motivated to reduce the cost, just the opposite. Increasing cost increases the rate base upon which that third party earns a return. Producers' commercial motivation is to develop the resources, not to leave them undeveloped. Therefore, we want to advance the project promptly, but with discipline, to ensure the costs are managed. And as we know, we heard from the Independent Project Analysis Group the mantra that schedule-driven mega projects fail. We don't want to fall into that mode, but we do want to deliver a prompt project. And finally, access to a producer-owned pipeline or a third-party-owned pipeline would be exactly the same. Doesn't matter, because access is governed by the FERC, FERC in the U.S., NEB in Canada. Regardless of who owns or operates the line, the rules are the same. So we have this amazing opportunity before us and one that has significant risk. The key is to get the risk and reward balance right. So how do we move forward? Well, as I mentioned, the producers can do some things to help overcome project challenges, like managing cost risk. And we think the state can also help overcome some of these challenges. In fact, the state's uniquely positioned to help overcome some of these challenges. We see this happening through an open process available to any project sponsor. We think if it's open and the rules apply to any party, that's where you get good ideas, the best ideas, and that'll allow, that's what's going to be required to allow a project to move ahead, allowing the free market to work. We think that process will take advantage of some common goals that we have. We're ready to see a pipeline project advance. We want that process to include legislative and public support, and we want that resulting project to maximize the value of Alaska's gas resources. I'd like to close with another look into the future, if I may. The future that I spoke about at the outset, the 50-year future, is right in front of us. It certainly captured the imagination of BP. It has incredible opportunity for the state, and it's the promise of future generations of Alaskans to come, and it's available to us. As exciting as it is to talk about that future and this project, we would much rather be rolling up our sleeves and actually working on the project. That's made possible once we jointly define that risk and reward balance. And so to close, just want to say that BP stands ready, willing, and able to work to that future in an open process that we described, that we can get timely resolution so that we can get started with the project. And thank you for your patience and the opportunity to testify, and I'd like to be happy to try to answer any questions that you have.
Okay. Start with Representative Roses.
Thank you. As a mathematician teacher for years, I like to kind of summarize things for my own clarification. So I realize that the major producers are in business to make a profit. You're not in business to break even. So if you didn't think this was a hugely viable project, you wouldn't have gone this far down the road. So I think that's a fair enough assumption to make. But in your estimation, and is it fair to say that you feel that the producers would be the ones that would be most effective in getting the gas to market because they have the greatest interest in doing so? I'm trying to summarize here. That they have the financial wherewithal to be able to attract the necessary investors to get this to go. You have the experience to minimize the risk while maximizing the profit potential, and also feel that you would be the ones best positioned to get this product to market more expeditiously than someone else would be as a result of the experience that you've had in Alaska in this type of work. Is that an accurate assessment of what I thought I heard you say?
Representative Roses, through the chair, I think basically that is. In a nutshell, I feel that we are the most qualified for the reasons that you mentioned, international experience and technical expertise and whatnot. But also key to that is the commercial motivation. Since we own the resource, we want to be able to deliver that resource to the market at the lowest possible cost. It's a unique motivation that we have as resource owners.
No further questions?
Okay. Building on that, BP is the largest marketer of natural gas in the states or not?
Representative Gatto, I know we are a major marketer, merchant marketer of natural gas. I'm not entirely sure if we are the top or not.
All right. I wanted to go back then to the words price taker, price maker. Mm-hmm. If you are a major marketer mm-hmm. and you're bringing your gas down the line, mm-hmm. are you really only a price taker?
Representative Gatto, yes, I think we are. We do market other people's gas. That's what I mean when I say merchant marketer. BP's production represents in the low single digits of the North American market, like 5 or 6% of the market. The market itself is highly regulated. We can't specify a price. It's a regulated market. The way in which you market gas, there's rules that regulate how you do that. So we can't set the price. We take the price that the market makes available to us.
Okay. You mentioned BTP, which I won't try to pronounce.
BTC.
Oh, that's even worse. Okay. What would you repeat those?
Those cities? It's Baku, Tbilisi, and Shahan.
Okay, and they form a grid of some sort, and I guess you had a fairly large project that had to do with gas and oil, and you've done the oil now?
Correct.
Is there a separate pipeline for the gas?
There's the South Caucasus pipeline, which is part of that BTC project, which is in the process of being constructed. I beg your indulgence. I'm not sure if that has been started up yet or not. It's close to being completed.
What kind of financial arrangements do you have with the host country?
The BTC project was actually built on the back, the midstream portion of the project that's analogous to this Alaska Gas Pipeline project was built on the back of a fiscal stability agreement with the governments of Azerbaijan, Turkey, and Georgia. And that provided for it provided the fiscal terms for the duration of that contract, which was 60 years. It's a 60-year fiscal stability contract.
So you have a lock on 60 years of gas pricing?
It's not gas pricing. It's on the fiscal terms associated with it's not a tax and royalty regime, but the analogy in Alaska would be on the taxes and royalties associated with that project. It's the government take.
Okay. And of course, there is a small difference or a large difference in owning a product and the right to develop a product. Is that a major difference?
Representative Gatto, the difference between owning a product or the right to develop a product?
You own the gas or just have a right to develop the gas? Is that a major difference in how you approach?
It depends, I guess, on the specific terms. If it could be structured, I imagine, to be commercially similar. I'm not sure exactly where you're getting at with the question.
I guess partly, we hear this so much from not license plate, but bumper stickers, mm-hmm. our gas.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with that.
Can you comment? Whose gas is it?
Well, the resource owners, in the case in Alaska, the lessees in the state get economic benefit from being able to sell that product in the market. We've entered into long-term lease agreements with the state to have access to that resource to sell it. So commercially, whether in effect or in legality, we get the economic benefit from that lease, and you could call it ownership or leasing it, but either way, we would get the economic benefit of being able to sell it in the marketplace.
Okay. And we treat it much the same way.
Yes.
Okay.
What's your intention, Mr. Chairman? Are we going to try to end on time as we didn't start on time, or are we going to continue?
Wendy, did you want to speak? Yeah, so we have another speaker here.
Before we move on, I have just a couple questions.
Sure.
On,
okay. What I'd like to do is stay as long as I can. I have a bill up in another committee, but if you can stay, I'll just turn it over to you and go get my bill heard and come back if there's time. It's
whatever works.
It's that 90-day stuff where everything is kind of being hurried along a little bit, and then the session came right on top of this. So if we could do that, go ahead and ask a question.
And I'm going to ask you to step out of your shoes a little bit here. How would a pipeline be financed if you didn't have the firm transportation commitments? What kind of resources would be necessary of a company or an entity or someone? I mean, what are we looking at? Is there anyone can do it? Are we talking Chevrolet, GM? I mean, what are we looking at a balance sheet to be able to float that kind of financing?
Representative Johnson, we're talking about financing, you know, 20 to 30, whatever the number is, billion dollars of investment, which is greater than the market capitalization of companies like the ones that you just mentioned. So this is not something that just sort of anybody can walk up and say, I'm going to finance this. Without the resources, whether that's ownership of the gas or the balance sheet, it would be like a promise that someone's going to buy your house from you. I'm going to tear your house down and build an apartment building. I don't have any money, but it's a really good idea, and I think I'm going to make money at it. Would you please let me tear your house down? You know, it may not ring very lucrative to you unless you have confidence that someone can actually backstop the investment required to deliver a successful project. So we're talking billions of dollars of financing necessary to enable the project to go forward.
Mr. Chairman, I think your answer was not very many, right?
Not very many companies. That's correct.
Could do that. I think I'll have additional questions. I know, but we'll go ahead and.
Representative Guttenberg has a question.
Thank you, and I'm sorry if I came in late. And maybe you covered this before. I don't know.
No problem.
I mean, I coming and going. It's kind of. I'm looking at you're ready for progress and non-exclusive rules. You know, the recent FERC ruling for open access for other entities, the state has a vested interest in making sure that any explorer and developer and producer has access to a gas line. And you're appealing those rulings, those FERC rulings. My impression, I don't know if that's right or wrong, or if that's you or Exxon or another entity. But, I mean, that's in the best interest of the state. And, you know, from my perspective, it's clearly being challenged by the producers. So, I mean, you're looking to be, come back into a partnership with the state.
Mm-hmm.
You're challenging what I perceive as our best interests. For your best interests.
Right.
And I'm concerned about that.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg, through the chair. I think the challenge that you're referring to is one that the three companies have made on Order 2005A on the narrow issue of whether or not the FERC should be able to mandate design changes after an open season. That's the only issue that's being challenged. Has nothing to do with a challenge to the open access rules, which we actually support. The project will be open access. We need exploration volumes to come into the pipe. That benefits everybody, helps keep the toll low. So that is in the state's interest. It's in our interest as well. The bit that's been challenged is just on the narrow issue of whether or not design changes after an open season can be mandated by FERC.
Well, from my perspective, in many ways, if I may, Mr. Chairman, it's the same thing. If they have an open season and is a desire for increased capacity, and the ability is there for design changes, but you have the ability to stop them, then again, you're just against control of access, whether it's granted or not.
Well, Representative Guttenberg, access to the line is granted under the Natural Gas Act. As an open access line, that means anytime there's an open season, anyone can obtain capacity to the line. And the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act of 2004, which still in effect, provides the opportunity for any party, if they feel that the pipeline would not hold an open season, that they have the FERC have the right to mandate that the pipeline hold an open season, and that's still the law of the land.
Exactly the question I was getting to, but I need to go, and I'm going to ask my co-chair if he'll take over the meeting and be back as soon as I can.
In your absence, we will build a pipeline.
Yeah. In 90 days.
You only got 10 minutes.
90 days.
And just to follow through.
Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair. In have the arguments been made in front of FERC? I'm just trying to figure what the timeline is.
Representative Guttenberg, I do not know.
Okay.
I apologize. I can find out for you and let you know, but I do not know today.
Thank you.
I have so many questions that I don't even know where to start, and I'm not sure that you would be necessarily the appropriate person. But we're talking about firm transportation commitments and open season stuff. Is there a way for a third party company that doesn't hold leases? Is there any way they can make firm transportation agreements? I mean, is this strictly the owners of the leases' availability to do this?
Chairman Johnson, the open season. Actually, if you look on the last page of your pack, there's a glossary of terms, and open season is just exactly what it says. It's open, and open access is exactly what it means. It's open. Any party can come to a open season on an open access pipeline, which in the United States, any natural gas pipeline, moving gas interstate is. Anybody can come to an open season and get capacity on the pipe if they make that commitment for a certain volume of gas for a certain period of time. No one can stop. I can't stop them.
And even the practicality of not holding a lease or anything would not prevent someone from coming in and saying, "I'll ship this amount of gas."
It's a corporate or an individual commitment. So it would behoove one to have the financial wherewithal to back up the commitment that they're making. But it's a corporate commitment.
And so if you can't deliver, are the persons who make that commitment on the hook for that, or is that the pipeline company?
Yes.
Okay.
It's typically referred to the usual commitments that are made, and there's different forms, but they commonly referred to as shipper pay commitments. So you're actually paying for the demand charge to move your gas down the pipeline, whether or not you choose to move your gas down the line. So someone that doesn't own gas today could go to an open season with the expectation that they're going to have gas to bring into the pipeline at a future date.
Just one more follow-up, and I'll move on to someone else. Can you give me a set of circumstances or some reasons why, and we're going to use a crystal ball here, and let's say that you're not the chosen pipeline constructor. Is there any reason why you wouldn't show up during the open season to make a firm transportation commitment?
Chairman Johnson, the key ingredients that would go into a successful open season, certain things I think would need to be met. One is there would need to be confidence that the cost that was offered was, we'd want to see a low-cost project and therefore a low tariff structure to ensure that we could get our gas to market for a reasonable rate. And the other thing is we would need to make to ensure as resource owners that those risks that we bear have been managed. And one key one would be, again, that the fiscal risk, for instance, on the upstream business. So that would still need to be dealt with in some shape, fashion, or form. Again, we think we as resource owners, for the reasons I mentioned, are best positioned to ensure that low-cost piece is delivered. Someone else could do it better than us for a lower cost for whatever reason, that's great as long as they can deliver that and the resource risks have been met.
Thank you. Any other questions? You got to go.
Yeah.
Conflict.
Already missed.
Are you not going to do this, Representative?
Yeah, and I won't ask too many legal
Good.
Questions.
Oh, come on. Wendy, you ready?
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Good to see you again. Thank you. You should state your name for the record.
Chairman Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Wendy King. I'm the Director of External Strategies for ConocoPhillips, working on the ANS gas development project for over 4 years now. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. What I'd hoped to do, Chairman Johnson, was to kind of give a couple introductory comments, then get specifically to the topic of why ConocoPhillips wants to take an ownership position in this pipeline, and then have a few closing comments. Before I get started, I would like to mention something that most people probably know, that I report to Mr. Joe Marushak, who has recently announced that he's moving on to Australia to be the president of our Australia business unit. I wanted to flag that our company will be bringing in a replacement for Mr. Marushak, and I wanted to just reassure everyone that we have on the ground a very experienced and capable team. And sometimes you may only see, like myself or Joe in different testimonies, there's a lot of people within our team that are helping this effort. And so we are committed to trying to advance the Alaska Gas Pipeline project. A couple introductory comments. Timing on this project is a real issue. And I think a few of you have probably heard Marianne Carr, chief economist, speak, and I actually believe that Marianne may be coming to speak to this committee at some point in the future. Issues that are in our, or at least on my mind, are that there is growing competition. Volatile markets. The natural gas market has been a volatile market. Volatile markets tend to correct themselves. The demand will look to additional or new sources to try to feed that demand with time. And so, you know, issues like coal, LNG, other energy sources, those are all on our mind. And Marianne will do an excellent job in being able to speak to those issues more than me. Another issue that I'd like to flag is competition for the actual critical components for the project. And I'm going to talk even more later about the cost of steel, machinery for the project, and the cost of labor. Those are all challenges we face. One thing I would like to highlight is that the project schedule that we've had out there for a few years of 9 to 10 years, I think recently even in the FERC report that came out, there is at least a common view that a project of this complexity and magnitude is going to take, and some of our best experts in our company trying to manage those project risks to ensure we could try to deliver it in that time frame of 9 to 10 years. So quickly on that introduction, I think it's getting quite important that the market does see Alaska Gas coming forward soon. And so from that perspective, I think you're going to see a sense of urgency for ConocoPhillips in trying to do what we can to find creative solutions to get this project moving forward. We believe that one of our core skill sets as a company is that we are problem solvers. And in fact, I get challenged on a daily basis, and so does our team, to be creative. And the term we use is to try to think out of the box. Is there a different solution, a different way to get there than was out there before? And I assure you that we want to work with you, the Alaska Legislature, and members of this committee, and Governor Palin, to try to find a solution that can make this project go forward. It's helpful that Mr. Van Tile had some pictures, and I think that's one thing going forward that I myself would like to continue to use as we communicate is more pictures. But one thing I wanted to echo what Mr. Van Tile said is the importance of the resource side of the equation. We believe that if the resource issues are addressed and those firm shipping commitments are made to a pipeline, the pipeline project will fall out. And so addressing those resource issues is a critical component, and it will be a feature of what I'm going to talk to you about today. Just to give a couple quick definitions, when I say resource issues, and I'm helpful, I'm glad that Dave had his pictures out there beforehand, but when I talk about the resource issues, what I'm talking about are the upstream portions of the project. So our position as a working interest owner in Prudhoe Bay, our position in Alpine as Explorer and NPRA, those are the types of resource issues that I'm talking about. Another term that I often talk about is what's the netback concept. And the netback to me, simplistically, is if the price in the market is $6 that day and it cost me $5 to get it from Alaska's North Slope to the market, the netback that I'm looking at is a dollar. And that's the dollar that I've got to have to cover all of my costs to find, explore, develop, pay taxes, pay the royalties on that gas. And so the netback concept in trying to deliver the highest netback project is something that we're keenly interested in. The long-term shipping commitments, just a flag, the long-term shipping commitment is effectively a commitment to the pipeline to say, I will pay to ship on this pipeline, regardless if I put gas on that pipeline day in, day out. And that commitment will be made in an open season process, so roughly about 18 months to 2 years after the project gets going again. So it is a commitment that would be made very early in the project, and as it will be asked of resource owners, it will be asked of potentially others to make those shipping commitments on this project, and those are key to the project being financed and the project being able to go forward. On the aspect of the project itself, if the cost itself, let me just highlight, if the cost in that shipping commitment, let's just assume that your shipping commitment was based on the theory that the toll was going to be about $3. If the cost ended up being much higher than that, let's just say $20 billion ended up being $40 billion, the toll is going to go up proportionally. And it is quite likely for a project of this magnitude, that cost will get passed on to the shippers. And so owners, working interest owners that could be asked to make shipping commitments like those in Prudhoe Bay and the state of Alaska as a royalty owner will be on the hook for those costs if they go over. And so we are uniquely motivated to keep those costs down. One thing I'd also flag is once that firm shipping commitment has been made, you can't change the terms. You can't say, oh, taxes have gone up, costs have gone up, oh, I can't pay that day. You've got to continue to pay that pipeline. It's a commitment that you've made to do that. I want to contrast that. There's some of the issues that are at least challenges that are in our mind as resource owners. On the pipeline side, on the other hand, there's a regulated return there. In fact, it's almost unique in that they do have stability, and that if taxes go up, there's a provision or there's provisions where they can pass that on in the toll. If the costs go up, they can pass that on in the toll. So basically, that is a low-risk investment with a regulated return. So that the two components of the project, the resource and the pipeline, have very different risk-reward balances between those two. In fact, you know, the only time a pipeline really has risk is prior to that open season, because once those firm shipping commitments have been made, that's really going to be what you're going to take to the financing community. That's what you're going to use to say, I've got somebody that's agreed to pay on this pipeline day in, day out for these numbers of years. So really, it's only that upfront portion prior to an open season, and I think we've estimated between a couple hundred million to $400 million gross to get to that open season gate 18 months to 2 years down the road. It does depend on the work that would need to be done in that. We had envisioned that there would be four seasons of environmental field data that would need to be done in that period to get ready for those environmental impact statements with FERC and NEB. And so there is, you know, it kind of comes down to whether the weather windows, can you get out there and get the data that you need prior to that open season.
Wendy, before you go on, yeah. That would be, that dollar figure is going to be consistent with regardless who has this pipeline or who ends up with it. Is that, that's a number that's fairly consistent, $200 to $400 million?
Chairman Johnson, I would actually, let me, from our perspective, I think we had previously felt that it was probably closer to a $400 million figure to get there, just because of the data impacted. I wouldn't want to feel or speak for other projects or others that might view it. I'm just looking at our schedule saying, let's look at it conceptually. When we were doing the engineering work back in 2001, 2002, it's my understanding that cost about $125 million, and that was roughly about a year's worth of work. So the concept of saying roughly $250 to $400 million fits with the fact that you're going to be ramping up, getting more engineers, you're going to be getting more people out in the field than what we were before. So that figure is consistent with what we would view, but I wouldn't want to speak for others.
Would you say that you're that much better or that much worse than anyone that we couldn't call this a fairly good number?
I think, Chairman Johnson, I think we've had some pretty good experts looking at this, and I think at least from what we've seen, that type of figure is consistent with the percentage that other big pipeline projects are spending trying to get to an open season.
Okay, now, so we're 18 months down the road, and we've had our we're getting ready for the open season, and no one shows up to make firm transportation commitments. What happens? Is that money gone? There's no recoverability. That's just $400 million down the drain?
Chairman Johnson, that would be at-risk dollars. In the scheme of this project, those $400 million are quite small. In fact, to get to the project sanction point, let me give you a quick summary of the timeline again here. Roughly 18 months to 2 years to get through the open, to get 18 months roughly to get to the open season. The FERC process clearly outlines about a six-month window for the open season, 90 days for them to review it, 90 days for the actual holding of the open season. Then it's roughly a two-year window to go through your permitting phases. After you've been through the permitting phases, both in FERC and NEB, that 2 years, we're roughly now 3.5 to 4 years down the road, you've actually got $1 billion up to the project sanction. But that period between open season and the project sanction, you've got some firm shipping commitments sitting behind it.
And I guess it's small, $400 million is small in the overall scheme of things, but it's rather large if no one shows up to the party and it goes down the drain and the responsible parties are on the hook for somehow this not happening. So I just want to let everyone, I guess the point I want to make is to get to where we can even start playing is $400 million.
Yeah,
roughly.
Chairman Johnson, on the $400 million, I'd echo in the scheme. Once again, I'll just echo. Yes, it is some exposure in that period. It's one of the few places there is some exposure. In the scheme of a project that has over $1 billion to get to project sanction and billions of dollars on the backside, that is a relatively small risk compared to the complete risk of this project, and the shipping commitments are going to be sitting behind it. So when you compare those, I'd ask to look at the whole project cost associated with it.
And I'm going a little different. I just want to point out that up until that point, that $400 million, whomever is building the pipeline, is on the hook for. And $400 million may not be much to you guys, but $400 million is a lot of money to the state. It's a lot of money to potentially other people. And once again, I ask what kind of balance sheet it would take to finance this. That's a lot of money up front, and I guess that's the point. I'm not trying to relate it to the whole project. I'm just trying to get on the record that we're talking a big amount of money just to go to the party. Representative Gutenberg.
Well, I don't want to pile on, but we're talking about $400 million in Alaska with dealing with the state and with FERC. What about the Canadian side? What is the commitment and the investment to get to an equivalent side, and timeline-wise, do they line up at all?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, actually the figures that I'm quoting are for the entire project, and that includes, in our mind, the A to B portions of the project, the commercial work that would need to be done, A to B, Alaska North Slope to Alberta portions of the project, and then also any commercial work, additional engineering work that might be done to develop that solution, the appropriate solution from Alberta down to the lower 48 market. So the cost figures I've thrown out are inclusive of the entire project that I call the midstream portions of the project, and I'm going to talk to that a little bit more later, what I mean by the midstream portions of the project versus the upstream costs of the project. So it does include, and those timelines that I've quoted are also the timelines that we would be working to achieve and in the Canadian portions of the project as well.
Maybe you can expand a little bit on the Canadian portions, because we got some communications from them, that were put up a lot of question marks. You know, it's like, well, what you're doing over there doesn't have a lot to do with us over here, whether it was, you know, First Nations issues or some of their regulatory processes.
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair. I'll be the first to admit I'm not an expert on the Canadian regulatory regime, but I can reassure you that we have people on the ground in Canada right now working the Alaska Gas Pipeline project, having conversations, trying to lay that foundation for when we start the project to begin the parallel path work that needs to be done. And we do believe that there is a solution in Canada. We believe that the project will bring benefits to Canada as well, and so we do believe we can get through Canada, but it takes the appropriate work to develop the solutions with the people that live in Canada as well.
Yeah, I think that's all part of getting to open season. Anything else? Yeah. No. Go ahead. We'll try not to interrupt.
But no, that's okay. I'm happy.
Questions.
You had to ask them to last year. No.
That's right. Yeah.
Just to continue on, then, is that a fine term,
please,
Johnson?
Go ahead.
Okay. One thing I would like to talk about, though, is that there have been a lot of misunderstandings about the project, and part of this I attribute to the fact that I remember testifying quite a bit last year, and it's a complex project. It takes a lot of us time. At least I know it's taken me quite a while to get up to speed with some of the issues, and there's still times I don't know the answers. The one thing that I want to caution, and I have a tendency to do this myself, is we could get into an endless discussion on what-ifs. And I find that, you know, at some point you got to focus on the size of the prize and get the project going forward. I do believe that moving the pipeline project forward and doing it in a manner that sets us up for as most successful project as possible will provide an endless opportunity for people to look at different things, whether that be spur lines, different ways to extract different portions of NGLs, other jobs, and probably something I'm the most excited about because I've worked in exploration in my past is the exploration opportunities and the new development opportunities. So I one part that I've heard some people talk about is, you know, there is a lot of emotion with some of these subjects. You know, one of them, I know, for example, every time one of us says fiscal stability, I hear that rings with people, you're challenging the state's sovereignty. Another one that goes the other direction is when I hear rolled-in rates, I'm thinking somebody's asking my company to subsidize somebody else. And that kind of rhetoric and those assumptions and the constant what-ifs is kind of the challenge that I think we face going into this next year here to find a solution. Those are legitimate issues, but they can't paralyze us. We've got to find a way to go forward. Another one that concerns me is that there's a dialogue about the fact that this project is wildly economic, or it is a guaranteed economic return. There's very, very few projects I've worked on, and none of them to the scale of this project, that I would ever say there's a guaranteed return on, because usually the largest risk in most of the projects we do have to do with three critical issues. What's the price of the commodity? What's the cost of the project going to be, and whether or not are the reserves going to be there, and can they deliver the reserves at the rate? Now, when I look at this project and I say, can I predict natural gas prices for the next 50 years? Well, of course, Wendy King cannot predict natural gas prices, and we've got experts in our company that look at that, and even our experts will tell us, you cannot. In fact, Marianne Caw, our chief economist, gave a fabulous slide the other day of showing what the natural gas price futures were from a year ago and what the actuals turned out to be in 2006. And I was surprised with the discrepancy in even over a one-year period in our ability to predict natural gas prices. And that was really a NYMEX comparison to what the actuals were. Another component of that is the project costs. You know, project costs, let's talk about that. The project costs, we know steel's increased. In fact, it's doubled since our 2001 study. And if I've had people ask, why are you hesitant in giving us a new cost estimate? There's a reason. We spent 1 million man hours studying the last cost estimate, doing some factoring up gives us some uncomfort that you're quoting a figure that may or may not be accurate. There's actually some engineering work, there's technical work, environmental work that needs to be done before we can feel that an updated cost estimate is going to have the rigor that it needs for us to quote that figure out there. But we know it's gone up. Steel's gone up, labor's gone up, and that's just the midstream portions of the project. Driving into, actually it was before I went to work yesterday morning, I heard Daniel Juergen of CIRA, and I think CIRA Week's kicking off this week, and so he was on saying that production costs have increased by 53%. I actually looked at some statistics we have internally, and I believe we've been showing, or Department of Energy has quoted, that finding, development, and production costs have doubled since 1999. Now there's going to need to be additional upstream development and exploration to get gas into this pipeline. So when we talk about the cost of $20+ billion, that doesn't include the costs that are going to be needed at the upstream fields to get those ready. And those costs are going up too. There's the commodity price side. I think most people know that in September of 2002, we had a daily low that was the lowest in 4 years, and we've also had some high prices again. I just flagged that it's volatile. It continues to be volatile. And then I would just add, there's just the sheer size and complexity of this project. I've had people say, you know, it's a $20+ billion project. It's just like doing $21 billion projects. I'm saying, well, no, it's not actually like doing $21 billion projects. The size and scope of what this project means, it's going to put a strain on certain resources within the world that a project of this magnitude, it's just not typical of a lot of your upstream normal projects that we do. And then I'd add the final one that I know Mr. Van Tile flagged, the resource risk. If we sign a 20-year shipping commitment, we're going to have to find more gas to fill that 20-year shipping commitment, depending upon, obviously, on the rate that you nominate it in. But it's safe to say that there needs to be some additional gas found. And so that's something that we're excited about doing, but it is additional investment, and we don't know for sure that those reserves will be there. Now, to move specifically to the topic of why COP wants to be an owner in the pipeline, I'm going to try to speed this up here, but most of it stems around the fact that this project is unique. It's a unique project. Those that have to pay that shipping commitment are going to be on the hook for tens of billions of dollars, potentially even higher, depending upon where the cost ends up being for those firm shipping commitments. It could be gross in the order of magnitude of $100 billion or more. So it's a significant investment. And, you know, like I flagged before, the key on that is trying to find a way to get the highest net back possible, that highest value at the wellhead, because what that delivers is many things. So the main reasons as to why ConocoPhillips wants to take an ownership position in the pipeline consistent with our shipping commitment are come down to these issues. Alignment of our project risk with that shipping commitment risk. Many of those risks are and those costs are passed on to the shippers. If the natural gas prices go down, we're still going to be paying. If they go up, we'll be paying that shipping commitment. But we're on the hook for that regardless of whether or not we're shipping gas that day and what the natural gas prices are. I would also flag that ownership in that pipeline, if you're in a scenario where you're in a low price environment, if you're paying that regulated return on equity to another party, if you actually own that pipeline, you've got almost a little bit of a natural hedge in that you're paying yourself in that low price environment. So there is an advantage to having that lined up. And it was actually an advantage I saw that would be there for the state if they had taken an ownership position as well. We're motivated to keep the costs down. You know, that's another reason. And that, like I said, because of that shipping commitment risk, we're motivated to keep those costs down. And we believe we bring project management, technical, environmental, regulatory, other skills to the project. For example, ConocoPhillips, we've operated in Alaska for decades. In our operations in Kuparik, we're the operator of Kuparik. We've been operating Kenai LNG now for, I think it's coming up on 40 years, I believe, something like that. We have extensive Arctic experience. We've been both in Alaska, Canada, other places in the world, we've been developing that Arctic experience. On a global scale, we've been involved in world-scale mega projects, and so we have that expertise to pull on resources worldwide to try to bring them to this project. And also, an interesting fact for me, we actually have expertise in many other aspects of this potential project. I was even surprised with some of these statistics. ConocoPhillips owns 29,000 miles of pipeline in our U.S. refining and marketing business. That's what we call our downstream side of the business. We also, through our midstream relationship that we've got with Duke Energy Field Services, we have 56,000 miles of U.S. pipelines there. We also have a huge position in natural gas liquids. With our co-venture Chevron, and the Chevron Phillips company, we're a significant player in the chemicals business. So when it goes to all potential aspects of the project, from the upstream to the midstream, to the downstream sides of the project. We've got expertise that we can bring to bear to the project. Another key issue as to why we think it's important, we would like to align our ownership interests with our shipping commitment, is that we're motivated to open this basin. We're the state's largest explorer and have been. We want to continue to see that happen. I mean, that we grow organically by finding new reserves. And so our goal is to actually open this basin. It's not to control the basin. We want to bring in partners. We want to work with other co-venturers. We don't like to drill normally exploration wells at 100%. And I know that I've worked with some exploration people, 100% working interest, let me flag. And the reason I'm saying that is we don't always find hydrocarbons. Sometimes we get dry holes. You know, some are better than others, but sometimes we have a dry hole. And so one tool that's been used is that you spread out your working interest in exploration wells so you can get a bit of a portfolio approach to what you're doing. So we want new partners. We want new entrants. We want to be able to explore this basin. I'd also flag that the higher the netback, the more motivated you're going to be to explore. If the gas that you get is worth more, you're going to be more motivated to go find it. One point I wanted to add, the challenge on Order 2005A, and Dave pointed out that's a narrow challenge, but one thing I wanted to flag about that, one of our concerns was once you've spent that time to get through that four-year window and have got the certificate, what we were concerned about is you got to move on to construction. At some point, you've got to be able to say, look, if you change the design on me right then, after 4 years of work, environmental, engineering, permitting, data, if you change the design then, you could go back and have to do the last 2 years, maybe even longer again. And so that was the concern, is we actually wanted to see the project go forward. And that's the narrow challenge that we were trying to do. So I think there was some alignment in what we were trying to do and set up a framework that ensures the project can move forward. The other things that I'd quickly mention are the financial strength. ConocoPhillips is a large company. We have assets of $165 billion. That was as of the end of 2006. We have access to capital and access to financial markets that will help with a project of this magnitude. And so we believe that's an important other criteria. And then the other one is we have access to the resource. ConocoPhillips is a 36% working interest owner percentage in Prudhoe Bay. We also own a small percentage in Point Thompson. We also have a big position in exploration and other assets on the North Slope. And so from that aspect, we can bring those issues to the table as well. One quick analogy that I've had some folks flag, and I'm actually going to use a couple analogies and why. The first one is, you know, owning a home versus renting a home. I can remember back if back in my college days when I did actually rent a home, or different times in my life where I thought I was going to live someplace for a short time. But effectively what somebody's asking us to do here is to say, look, will you sign up to rent a home for 20 plus years, maybe even the rest of your life, sign up to rent this home, but you don't actually know what the rent's going to be. Could be $1,500 a month. It could be $3,000 a month. But I'm being obligated to sign up for that. If I'm going to sign up for that, I'd rather own the home. You know, it's just from my perspective, it's a simplistic analogy that I'm trying to draw to. Another one that, you know, I was thinking about on the way down here is I kind of grew up in a farming community. And I've looked at a lot of farmers over the years that have been able to make it go and some that haven't been able to make them go. And actually, one of the key fundamentals has been some of those farmers that say, I'm not going to rent this farmland for the next 40 years. I'm going to go buy that farmland. Those have done particularly well in time. And so the whole issue of leasing something long-term versus owning, I think it's been looked at many times, and I think you can find some your own analogies to compare to on that. With that, I'll conclude today by just having a few key summary points that I wanted to leave you with. We're ready to solve issues. In fact, a colleague of mine just said, roll up your sleeves. I'm anxious to get to roll up my sleeves and start to think about new solutions out there. We think we've got to address those resource issues. Providing the adequate securities that those of us that are going to be asked to make long-term shipping commitments, there's some big issues with that. We need to start talking about those. We think, you know, just let's compare that back here for a second. Prudhoe Bay is what's unique to making this pipeline project happen. We have I think the three of our companies have working interest owner positions on that. We will be asked to consider making large shipping commitments associated with that big natural gas resource out there. We believe as ConocoPhillips there's value in us aligning our ownership position with our shipping commitment. We want to continue to explore the possibility of that with the state of Alaska. We think timing is important. We don't want to rush into a bad deal, but we think we need to act diligently in trying to find those solutions. We want to find new ways to come up with compromise to move this forward. And we have to keep focused. We need to keep focused on the big prize. The real prize on this project is tens of billions of dollars of revenues. If natural gas prices hold, if we can manage the costs, it will also create a new exploration business for gas. And so from that context, we're motivated to try to find those solutions. With that, I'll close my comments. Thank you for your time, and I'll try to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Everything? I think that's it. I appreciate you coming in. I would like for you to try to answer the same question that may not be answerable that I ask of others as to when TAPS becomes uneconomical and we can start flowing new oil down that and we actually have revenue generated from a pipeline. That period is very interesting to me because that's going to be a very tough time for us to do, and the longer we stretch it out, I think the more painful it's going to be. So anything you could do to help me get my hands around that concept would be greatly appreciated, because I think that's the next five, that whatever period it is going to be a fairly rough time, and I'd like for it to be short. So, but I do want as good information as you can get me. Any other questions? Any other comments from anyone in the audience, you think? With that, if you're willing to stick around, Representative Grunberg, if you have additional questions, I'm going to adjourn this and let everyone
late
go.
For something else. So.
Excellent. Thank you. With that, adjourn. Thank you.